Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos.
Yeah, right. Crazy.
Hello, how are you? That still tickles me, that music. So, welcome to part 2 of episode 115 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. So it turned out that part 1 of Jeffrey Harrison's podcast went down exactly how I thought it was. I've had plenty of love and positive comments about it, and a couple of good stories about people's interactions with the Samaritans, which, if you haven't listened to part 1 of this episode yet, Jeffrey works behind the scenes at a Samaritan centre. And I will be giving the number out again at the end of this episode. I won't keep you too long, I'll go straight into part 2. But what I will do for anyone that hasn't listened to the first part, I'll seamlessly edit in the little bit of info that I'd done at the start of part 1. Although I strongly recommend you listening to that first because it was a corker. But anyway, after completing an undergraduate degree in fine art printing from the School of Art in Hull, he lived in Japan for several years. After returning to the UK to complete an MA in London, Jeffrey now lives and works in London, where he was an artist in residence at Bart's Pathology Museum at St Bart's Hospital, and recently completed a residency at the Royal Veterinary College. He has a studio in Bermondsey and exhibits in the UK and internationally. His practice is often collaborative and in partnership with other individuals, organisations and institutions, teaching, facilitating workshops, presenting seminars and talks, and curating work by other artists. So, that out of the way, come and listen to the man himself, Jeffrey Harrison, as him and I had a great chat over Zoom.
None of my family and friends have ever been to a fucking gallery, you know, let alone into art. And when I said I wanted to do this fine art degree, people are going, oh, you could go into sign writing, or you could be a tattooist.
Yes.
You know, because that's as far as their aesthetic mind can take them, you know. And I was going, that doesn't interest me in the slightest. No disrespects to anyone who does that.
No.
Fucking fine. But I want to go and I want to see my work up on a gallery wall. I want someone to stand in front of it. And people are going like, but, you know, you won't earn from that. And I said, I don't care. I'm going to have a fucking happy life.
I'm
fucking skint at the moment, but I'm fucking happy being in this world.
Yeah, that's a good, that's definitely a good way for people to be taught about art when they're at art school is.
I'm happy to be one of the 97%.
Yeah, yeah, Yeah.
I might even have a jacket made up, you know, like the Hell's Angels have, but they have one percenter on it.
Don't yeah, they? Yeah.
97 percenter.
Yeah, yeah, one of the 97 art school, 97%. Yeah, that's a good idea, because what they should do, instead of saying 3% of you are going to make it, they should say 97% of you are going to be happy, because brilliant, you're going to be making art for your own.
I can write that down. That's good.
People probably say this to you a lot. You know, when they find out that you're an artist, one of the things that people say is, oh, I can't draw. And you think, yeah, okay, yeah, fine. Maybe that's how you feel about it. And I'm not going to try and change your mind about things. But drawing's not like a mystical, like, thing that you... You know,
exactly. The bloke who taught me, he showed me about, I think I got it on about the fourth way he showed me how to draw, third or fourth. I went, fucking hell, that's it. It's all size and proportion. But he said it was all to do with maths. And I was like, of course. So turned away from being a skill to being a sort of mathematical sort of, you know, if this part of your eye is 4 centimetres,
yeah,
the gap is 4 centimetres. And then I saw each bit as an object rather than a person's face, how it connected with me.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you talk about maths, because it's another thing that people say when they, you know, when, so my brother's a mathematician.
I'm shit at maths. Think,
yeah, well, that's what people say, I'm shit at maths. And it's like, well, I question both of those responses. Like, I can't draw, I'm shit at drawing, or I'm shit at maths. Because they may be true, and they may be, you know, beliefs held with, you know, good reason. But actually, usually it's because of the way that they've experienced those things to that point. Like, most people draw when they're kids without any kind of judgment. All they want to do is, like, draw that. My son draws Pokemon all the time.
Brilliant.
And dragons. And all he wants to do is just get it on paper. He wants to see the thing that he's thinking about. Yeah. And I love that. And he doesn't, he gets a bit cross sometimes when it's not coming out right. And so he screws it up and he might start again and sort of hands off on that sort of thing, because, you know, I don't want to give him a kind of complex. But everybody starts off drawing like that when they're a kid. They just want to get it out. They love the idea that they've taken something from inside their head and put it onto a page and it looks a bit like that thing. But actually, as you get older and your worldview becomes more grown up, you start to demand more from your visual world. And so you start to demand more from the drawings you do. And when they fall short, which of course they will, if you're not keeping up your drawing, then you'll just look at the drawings you're doing and you think, well, they're no good. That's a bit shit.
Yeah.
And so what you find is that most people say they're shit at drawing because they haven't drawn since they were like 10 at school.
Yeah.
And of course their drawings are like those of a 10-year-old, of course, because if you don't use it, that's you sort of stay at that level. And the only reason why people are bad at drawing is because they might not enjoy it, because they have an association with it not being good. Well, they just simply don't do it. And I teach people drawing. When I teach them, I say, look, you know, it's like playing football or anything that you in those spheres, you accept that you have to spend quite a lot of time getting good at it. And at least playing football or running the 100 meters, you know that those guys spend hours and hours and hours a day in training and practice and theory and all that kind of stuff to get good. Well, of course, it's the same for, you know, drawing a picture. But the more you do those things, the better you get.
Yeah.
And like you found, like, there are certain techniques that you can use to just unlock it a little bit and make you realize something new about how you can do it. And they mean that you just carry on and on and on. So I don't accept that there's people who are good at it and there's people who are bad at it. I just think there's people who do it and people who don't. I think sometimes you might need something which isn't about a skill in your hand or anything like that. It might be about an ability in your eye to see what's not quite right. So, you know, Instagram's a great place for looking at other people's art, and people are, you know, people that follow me, I always go and have a look at their work. You know, if anybody follows me on Instagram, I always go and have a look and see what they're doing. And sometimes really interesting, because you can see sometimes what you see is that this person is trying really hard because they've got tons of work. You know, you look through hundreds and hundreds of images that they've got on their things. So they're obviously doing a lot of it. But what they may not have is a kind of a critical eye, which sometimes that can be really disabling, I think, you know, inhibiting to be very overcritical about your own work. But sometimes in order to get better, you have to be able to look at it quite dispassionately and critically and say, this isn't good. Or like you said before, have somebody else tell you, you know, honestly, what is good and what is not good. Because if you can't make those value judgments about the thing that you're doing, it's very hard to improve. And to know where you are going wrong, because other people do know that, you know. And if you perhaps, I don't know, if you wanted to win a competition or enter a, you know, enter the, you know, something drawing prize, or, you know, to get on somehow and develop in your thing and be successful in inverted commas, whatever that might mean to you, you need to improve always. And if you can't see where the opportunities for improvement are, i.e. the bits that you're a bit shit at, then you're not really going to make it there to those aspirations. So you kind of have to be good at being able to receive criticism and also to digest it properly and recognize where it's going wrong, because you're only going to be, you're only going to make art as good as your inner critic will allow.
I agree.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Seeing through PR is a really tricky thing, isn't it, for art? Because you kind of want the art to do the PR for itself, you know, especially if you're doing visual art, you know, you kind of want your stuff to sort of stick out. Although a mate of mine was saying to me yesterday, she said, do you know, when I go in galleries, I'm not really a very visual person. I don't really like looking at pictures in galleries, but what I do like doing is reading the blurb at the side.
Nice.
And like, I like those stories. So she likes the stories. So for her, she would need a bit of PR in terms of a bit of explanation. This is what this person's work is about. And then she might go, okay, you know, I get the picture now. But when, because some PR, particularly on things like Instagram, is really funny. Like, you know, you can pay for stuff, can't you, on Instagram? You can pay for ads, and you can... And some people, like within Instagram, I get these messages saying, hey, do you want to be featured on my art page? All you got to do is send me like $5 or something, and I'll put you on there. I'm like, I never, ever want to do anything like that, because it just wouldn't feel right. But like, some people pay Instagram, don't they, for a promotion?
Times. Never fucking works. It hasn't worked for me.
Hasn't it?
No.
I've never tried it. A few of my mates have tried it, and I don't know what their results have been like. I really asked them, but like, that's one way of doing it. But often the ones that I get, you know, that it says sponsored underneath or something, doesn't it? Sponsored thing. Because I look at my feed and I go, oh, that's interesting, because that's nothing to do with what I normally would see. No. So I always wonder about social media, because like, for art, because I found Instagram really helpful for me within Instagram. And it has got me some work. You know, people have contacted me and say, can you do this kind of commission? Can you do this kind of thing? So brilliant. I've got some work from it. But actually, you know, when you die, they're not going to put on your gravestone, had 10,000 followers.
Yeah. Or, please like this tomb.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, and stuff like that. So, you know, those, not that I do my artwork for that kind of legacy, but you've got to remember that, like, Instagram, it actually doesn't matter how many followers you've got. It's a sort of a metric that measures a kind of a nothing. And like, if Instagram or Facebook or all these things were suddenly out of our lives, what do you have left? Unfortunately for me, I still have all my paintings, and I still have a purpose for making them. And there is a place out there where you can show them. But it's a tricky place, you know, it's galleries and things like that. And I don't, you know, I don't have a gallery. I don't have a gallerist. I don't have any of those kind of relationships. So I think it's really hard for young, but people starting new, you know, doing art. I still think of myself as actually starting quite new, which sounds a bit silly, because I actually made a decision to become an artist when I was about 30, 34, I was always painting, and I had things in some exhibitions and stuff, but I never decided to become an artist until my girlfriend at the time and my wife said, you need to start calling yourself an artist because you could do this. You know, you could get into this world. But that was like only 10 or so years ago.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like I've only been an artist for about 10 years and a portraitist for about 7 or 8 years, I think, something like that. I did my first portrait in 2013, I think.
Nice. Well, saying that similar sort of thing, I was struggling with, and you may have heard me speak about this, I've mentioned it so many times on here, I was struggling with the two lives that I had. I had my old life as criminal, you know, non-artist, and then the new life as an artist. And for several years, I was dragging both of these lives around with me, and it was really difficult for me. And then just at one point, I just decided to separate the two by giving the old life a name. And that name was Roy Maynard, which is a name that I used to sort of give the police or book into an hotel with. That was my dodgy name in my old life, Roy Maynard. Because I'm a different person now to what I was years ago. So I've got a different personality as such, you know, I'm definitely a different person. So he is a different person and he has got a name. And then there's obviously the new Gary Mansfield, who's the sort of arty, farty, non-criminal, non-violent, you know, that person. So then I separated them. And it was, as soon as I come to terms with that, which maybe took a week or so, a couple of weeks, fucking hell, the pressure that it relieved by just separating these two bits of my life was amazing. And if I had had someone years ago who knew about the mind, you know, a psychologist or someone like that, just said, like, do that. You know, if I knew that it was a thing that you could do, how easy it was. It just helped me so much. It's like we excuse children for the things they've done. When they get to 18, all of a sudden you're accountable. That's what I do. I was a child up until I was like fucking 28. I was a different person. I had a different mindset. That weren't me. Now I'm not that. So I don't sort of, because I was like worrying about apologising for things I'd done years ago. Because I'd done a lot of bad shit. And I was carrying that around me. And I was like, well, I was a criminal. I'd done crime. You know, that was the job description. I'm not doing that job anymore, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. I always think about, do you ever watch My Name is Earl? When I first sort of saw that, I thought about the kind of catharsis that guy was going through. He's basically written down all the people he'd wronged, hadn't he?
I remember that.
He got a load of money somehow. He won some kind of lottery or something, and he decided that what he was going to do with the money was to make a list of all the people he'd hurt or wronged in his life and go back and make it up to them. And it was about how that basically just is funny. And it doesn't work. And I thought that was a really interesting way of dealing with your past or one's past is to there's a kind of a sense that you kind of want to make amends for it. And but that's quite self-serving, isn't it, sometimes?
Everybody else has moved on. That situation has moved on. They're either carrying it or most of the time they've forgotten it and think you're an arsehole.
Yeah, exactly. And the only person it fixes is your conscience about, like, because I've done this, you know, I've got in my head all the things, I even wrote down all the things that make me cringe about the life and the things I've done in my life. And most of them are things to do with things I've said to girls or stuff like that, you know, in order to, you know, whatever, or, you know, silly things I've done to appear like a, you know, to be a cool, funny guy or whatever.
Yeah. The things that aren't you, because I've found the things that make us cringe are when we step too far beyond the boundary of our personality.
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about PR just now. At one point, when I was going to exhibitions and I'd work, someone went to me, look, just do this, be a bit more self-assertive, be a lot more forward and be, you know, and I tried that and it worked all right to that person, but every word I was saying, I was cringing and I'm making up the words and it just weren't me and it didn't fucking work. It might have worked to that person, but half a dozen people would have gone, fucking hell. You know what I mean? 'Cause it wasn't me. I wasn't being truthful.
Yeah, I mean, things like that, you always feel inauthentic, don't you? Because it's not you're not being yourself. So I quite like that. The things that make you cringe are the things that, as you said, the things that you do that are outside yourself. But I still think, though, sometimes it's important to step outside of, because you develop then, don't you? You become, but as long as you're not going like, as long as you're not making an arse of yourself. Yeah. Basically.
Yeah. Well, sometimes, you know, you can, that stepping stone could be in the right direction.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a clock. 12 o'clock is the right direction, and there's another 11 that are the wrong direction. You step those, and yeah.
That's yeah. I never thought about that. But it was quite a good experience for me. I didn't have to, I certainly didn't feel like I needed to go and apologize to all the people who I'd like offended or whatever. Like, you know,
I've got enough time left in my life to go and apologize to people that I've wronged in the past.
And again, like saying before, like they don't care, and it won't help them for you to say you're sorry. The only person it helps is you. So you got to just let that stuff go.
Yeah, and worst way, if they think you're an arse and then they find out that you've changed, they go, "Oh, fucking hell, he ain't the arsehole I thought he was." Win-win, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
If there was you and five other artists, Jeff, past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
I love this question. I like this one. It's a good, because this is, it's a bit like, you know, who inspires you or whatever. So, and I've listened to some of the people who've answered this, and I thought, yeah, was it one person, was it Matt Collishaw said it would have to be five people who I didn't think were as good as me.
Brilliant.
So that my work looked better. Yeah.
A good honest answer.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty honest. I think for, I don't know, I did think, I've thought about this one a lot ahead, and it's an opportunity for me to go, these are my influences, and these are people who I align my work with. Actually, what I'd be interested in, and what I'm always interested in showing with other artists, is having a private view. I love a private view.
Yeah.
I love like the formal version of this, you know, where there's a gallery, there's a load of wine that's free, and you get to just chat to people and get drunk. And I like that. So it would be more about, who do I want to hang out with at a private view, and get under their skin a bit and find out a bit more about their practice and, you know, what makes them tick and things like that. So there's a list of about 100 people.
Of course. And it's going to change if I ask you tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. So like, but there'd be people like Holbein. He's a great one.
Yeah.
Because I kind of want to understand about his process. So if I could find out about not just his painting, because I think his painting's obviously very good, but his drawing, I'm really interested in his drawing, which is, I don't know if you've ever looked quite closely at them. They're usually done using a kind of a chalky kind of thing, but they're so precise and controlled, but beautiful. The lines are just beautiful, and I just want to know whether it's all practice or whether he's using some sort of visual aid, because I think there's a lot of optical development around that time when he could have been using something, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that lots of people like to believe that those kind of things weren't being used in those days, so I kind of want to know about whether he was using some kind of almost like a camera obscura or something like that, a scribing technique, because that actually doesn't take away from the fact that his drawings are just gorgeous and beautiful and so minimal and masterful. So somebody like that. My mum actually put me on to, when I was really young, my mum, I remember showing me paintings that she liked. And at the time she was into Piero della Francesca, who is an Italian Renaissance painter, did lots of frescoes. He's got some paintings in the National Gallery, and one of, I think it's St. Michael with a serpent that he's standing on. And his paintings are just beautiful. And I think it was my mum talking about his work just aligned my eye to a kind of a beauty in painting and proportion and just a kind of beauty, because he's painted this very beautiful man wearing armor and holding a sword and standing on a serpent that represents Satan, and And whenever I go and look at this, I look at this every time I go into the National Gallery, if it's up. And it never ceases to give me interest.
Yeah.
So I love his composition and Paolo Uccello as well. So that's going quite far back, isn't it? I probably want my mum there because my mum is a brilliant painter. Nice. And she's entering a whole new way of work at the moment. It's all connected to her previous work. But she's been introduced to Instagram as well now, which is a sort of a double-edged sword because, you know, it's been brilliant for her work. And I love to see what inspiration she's taken from it and how much it's propelled her further.
She's on there a lot.
But she's on there quite a lot, yeah. And she...
put your phone down and eat your dinner.
Well, she's doing what mums do, which is to kind of troll their children on Instagram without really realising that's what she's doing. Because she's always, like, commenting on my work. But she's always commenting on other people's comments about my work as well. And I'm like, oh, mum. So we've had words about that. So she'd be there. Somebody whose work I really, really love, but everyone really, really loves her work, is Jenny Saville.
Brilliant.
She's a fantastic painter. But not just her treatment of paint, you know, on a canvas, but her approach to the human body and her own body and her no holds barred, this is flesh, this is humanity, and this is a big piece of canvas with a load of wet paint applied to it that coalesces into a way that makes this statement and form. I think it's fantastic. How many more have I got? Have I got one more? Have I got none
more? But talking about Jenny Saville there, you get that sense. She does a little something with her visual language that is so inclusive. You know, I mean, it's mainly women that she paints, but I feel a part of her work all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
I have done ever since I first saw it. It is as if she's talking about humanity rather than just that woman in the painting.
Yeah, I know, I think so. And what I like about it is that everything goes on in that painting in a very, not unselfconscious way, but do you know what I really hate, and it's not in her work, in the way that I hate it in other people's work, is where you see a dribble and you know that that's been put there. Yeah. You know? And I look at it and go, like, that wasn't a dribble that happened because you were making that mark over there and you just can't be asked to get rid of it. That's a dribble that you've put there, or a smudge that you've put there, because, I know, it gives your work what you see in other people's work.
Yeah, yeah.
But when it's in her work, it's because it's part of the energy and the process of building up the painting.
The freedom of the brush.
So there's no kind of contrivance in her work except for the fact that, and she has a way of putting down paint with the mark on her brush that is, and it's something always very tactile and masterly about it. Anyway, so I think her painting's fab.
And the last one?
Well, I suppose out of deference to you, Gary, I should probably put in somebody who's not just a figurative painter. I should, so I put in somebody like, people might be surprised that I choose somebody like, Damien Hirst, who's such a figure on the art scene. You know, if you think about YBA or you think about British artists now, I mean, there's lots of people you might think about: Bacon, Auerbach, you know, Freud, all those kinds of people, or Tracy Emin, or any of those whose work I actually like more than his. But there was one bit of work that I saw of his. And it was a Tate show somewhere. It might have been in New York, though, so it wouldn't have been at the Tate. Anyway, it was the one where he's got a cow's head in a glass vitrine, and then in another vitrine he's got next to it with a hole between them, he's got like an electrical thing, a bug zapper. Whether it's in the same one, I can't remember. I remember looking at it and not really liking his work before, thinking, oh yeah, shark in a tank, yeah, blah, blah, blah. But actually when you when you actually engage with some of his work, like I did that first time, and it was an old piece by then. This was not that long ago. Yeah. And I saw, it was called, what was it, 1,000 Years or something like that? And I was really, really impressed. I was just blown away by the poetry and the
circle of life, wasn't it?
Of this complete circle, yeah.
Because there was sugar in there as well, wasn't there? For flies to feed on.
Flies were fucking laying eggs, maggots coming, flies would fly off, zap on the thing. It was just beautiful.
It was amazing.
Cycle of doing this stuff. I just thought that is beautiful. And the other thing I thought that was really beautiful was his use of a cigarette as a life, you know, as a sort of a cigarettes in an ashtray, and each cigarette kind of represented a life lived.
Was it a big ashtray that you're on about?
Well, he did loads of them, actually. He did this huge ashtray, but some of them were just, I think one of them was just a single cigarette.
Oh, got you.
And some of them were photos, I think, as well. But I just loved that picking of one little object, that very personal object like a cigarette, because you put it in your mouth and there's something about mouths that are more personal than almost anything else. And you put it in your mouth and you draw on it, and everybody knows that it's bad for your health and it reduces your life by, you know, minutes and things. But it's also about enjoyment, isn't it? Because people smoke because they like it, you know, and it's something that you do. And so for me, that cigarette representing a human life, I thought was really, really good. I thought that was really, really clever and simple and quite beautiful. And so I would like, I'd like him to be there so that I could hear more about that stuff.
Jeff, if you wasn't an artist, what would you like to be?
I'm already other things. And I kind of think that if I wasn't working, you know, in the charity sector, I'd want to be an artist. Do you know? And I could, it'd be horrible to think that I had to give up being an artist, because I do that alongside everything else I do. So even if I gave up working at Samaritans and went to work in, I don't know, catering or retail or banking or whatever, I'd like to think that I would still be doing art. Yeah. So getting rid of the art bit and what I would replace that with in my life, I don't know. I could probably have a hobby then, because I don't know what it would be, though. I don't know, maybe science-y stuff. I was always a bit of a duffer at school. I don't think I've ever been especially dim, but I've always been especially lazy. And I think that if there was the one thing that I really like reading about these days, and like I said before, reading for me means listening to audiobooks. But if I was going to be doing reading these days, I quite like popular science, so I might be interested in that. But
see, it's funny, because people who've had art in their life, all of their life, they're the ones who don't know how to answer this question.
Yeah.
The people that have discovered art, they go, I'd like to be a butcher, you know, I'd like to be a designer. They sort of, they've always got something else that they've always wanted to do. It just so happens art was one of those.
Yeah.
Whereas people like yourself have always grown up with art, they, because it's always been there, you know, they
Yeah, that's funny, isn't it? Yeah, no, I can see how that might be. I tell you what, though, you know, if I ever was able to earn a living doing the art exclusively, which is just something I want to do, but I mean, I enjoy working and getting the stability from work. And I think there's a lot of good artists, yourself included, who do art and will always do it now. But also do other things, you know, and there's no sort of shame in that. And it's not a measure of success that you do another job. I mean, it is a great thing. Sorry?
That sort of thing doesn't even enter my mind. I mean, I only started work 18 months ago myself to make this leap. And, you know, it was a leap into the dark, and you know, I've still not found a light yet.
Yeah, exactly. Still falling. But I mean, it's great when, you know, when I do meet artists who are doing it full time, because that's quite inspiring, and the life that they have is, you know, is quite interesting, with their art being at the very center of it rather than being something which you're drawing towards the center of it as close as you can get it. I mean, the idea of being a full time artist is a kind of mystery to lots of people. And I think even for artists who are not it, to think about doing it, you probably find that you spend more time not painting or whatever it is your practice is, and more time doing your talking to your accountant, or you know, doing the PR-y bit, or you know, dealing with your existential angst that comes along with not having another thing going on. But if I were I think a full-time artist, one of the things I think I would quite like to do would be to and I don't know why I think this, because I think I'd be dreadful at this, is to be an actor, to perform somehow. I don't think I can sing very well. I can't play any musical instruments, so I don't know why I think performing would be for me. But I just like the idea of inhabiting other people,
a different persona.
Yeah, a different persona. So even I don't mean like an actor on telly or in. In movies, I don't mean that kind of glamour or the Hollywood bit. I mean like on stage, or I could do what I used to do, which when I was at art school, I used to get the train back to back home. I always used to pretend that I was somebody else, that I was traveling for business or something.
I've done it so many times.
Like yeah. I used to, because I didn't want to, because you know when you're on the train somewhere, you end up talking to people, or I do anyway. And I kind of wouldn't like to tell them that I was at art school, not because I was ashamed of it, but because we'd always have the same conversations about painting or whatever, you know. And I just didn't want to have that, so I always used to say that I was just working, and I would invent something about sales or something. Yeah. And often, I think one time I even got a suit from a charity shop and wore a suit on the way home because I thought that that would make me appear to be somebody else.
But in the truth of it, you're the only one who saw the suit. Everyone else,
I know, everyone's like, I just anonymous. There's and they probably looked at my shoes and went, look at that art school kid wearing suit, thinking he's being somebody else.
We used to do a bit of minding years ago for like comedians and actors and that sort of thing, and it'd be just me and me mate then, and a lot of the time we'd be waiting for them while they're on stage or on set. We'd be floating about somewhere just as we was like starting to have this conversation, and it could have been with a guy just sitting there as well, just having a chat. Dan would say to me, you're a plumber, and I'd go, oh, you're a soldier. And then we would just, and I go, oh yes, that's me mate Dan, he's in the Royal Marines. And
he'd go,
yeah, he's my mate Gary, he's a plumber. We wouldn't say it like that, but we'd know what each other's role was, and then we'd just start talking, and like gradually we'd sort of make it a bit more ridiculous every moment, you know, and just for a laugh. But we would do that for years. And when I said to someone that I can't act, and they go, fuck off, that's how I met you. You know, you told me you was a fucking cameraman or something.
Yeah.
And there's me saying I can't act, and you do those sort of roles throughout your life, just messing about.
Yeah, I mean, now this is what you're saying now, and who you're being now, and who I'm being now. I mean, they're only versions of ourselves, aren't they? They're not. You wouldn't have this conversation in this way with the same sort of brain, sparks that are, going off when you're thinking about stuff with somebody else, because it just wouldn't be that same conversation. Yeah. So you're just a different person all the time.
Funnily enough, I've taken people into jails before when I'm giving like a talk or something. And I do say to them just beforehand, I say, I'm going to be talking a little bit different when I get in there, because although I've disconnected myself from my past, to talk to these people, I've got to go back a bit closer to my past, throw on a bit of a gallblimey, that sort of thing. Have you got anything coming up, Jeff? I know it's a bit weird in these moments we're in at present, but have you got anything
coming up? Well, so I'm obviously doing all this stuff on Instagram. So I'm nearly finished with this Baldy Beardos project. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with that. You were talking about, you know, having them as a big sort of thing, and I want to exhibit them or show them somewhere. I was thinking about getting them all into a kind of a book. I thought that'd be quite a nice way of doing that. But I also want to show them. So I've got that. I've also got that is just going to continue. I'm just going to keep doing that. I'll never stop doing that, I think. I'm always painting. I'm working. I'm just finishing up self-portrait at the moment, which is the one with the duct tape in it. And I've got one painting of self-portrait of me looking really sad, which is in I've got into the Royal Society of Portrait Painters annual exhibition. So that's I'm really pleased about that. It's a very trad group. I mean, you can't get a much more like traditional group of painters, can you? The Royal Society of Portrait Painters of Great Britain. And it does sound a bit stuffy, but I mean, there's some brilliant painters actually in the RP, as it's called. Really, really good painters who I admire hugely. It's not what you'd call contemporary. Well, actually, some people would call it contemporary fine art, but it's not very aligned with the kind of stuff that we're talking about, you know, like Jenny Saville or you know, conceptual art or anything like that. But it is usually like every year kind of a showcase of some of the best sort of figurative painting, not just in Britain. I think they take submissions from overseas, but mostly it's in Britain because of the practicality of it. And I've never been able to get in before. And this is the first time I've got in. So for me, it's very, you know, same we were saying before about being validated. Yeah. You know, for me, that's quite validating, even though it's a show that's it doesn't have a lot of room for the conceptual or the sort of art school fine art thing, which I'm still aligned with. It is a very rigorous selection process and means that I'm super stoked to have got selected for it.
That's really so. And rightly so. Where can people see your work, be it social media or website?
Yeah, I've got my social media, got all my social medias. I don't do the TikToks, but I do. I do. Imagine on TikTok. I don't know what I do on TikTok, but I am on Instagram with my name, Jeffrey Harrison. That's it. I think you can find me from that. I've got two websites. So I've got jeffreyharrisonportraits.co.uk. That's my, I don't want to call it, my commercial art platform. Yeah. So people can commission me there and they can look at all the portraits and they can look at drawings. There's a load of stuff in there and some still lifey kind of stuff as well. And then I started off actually with a different website, which is just jeffreyharrison.co.uk, so without the portraits bit at the end. And that has got a bit more of the work that I was doing before I really shifted my focus towards portraits. There's some portraits on there, but there's some other stuff that I was doing, which was about where I used to focus on the, which we haven't talked about here, and there's not ever enough space to talk about this kind of stuff, but it's the collision point between art and science. Nice. I still am interested in how science informs art and art informs science. And so I was doing quite a lot of collaborative work and had done a couple of residencies that were one at the pathology museum at St. Bart's Hospital, where they've got loads of stuff in jars. And I was really interested in anatomy and ideas about the body and parts of the body and wholeness.
Which is where Glenn Hirst got his idea from for...
Yeah, I think so. I think there's quite a few artists who I quite liked at the time who were doing stuff to do with body and body, not in a macabre way, but you know, maybe in a slightly dark way, but still in a beautiful way. I think it was about beauty. And then after that, I did a residency at the Royal Veterinary College, where obviously they were talking about animal science or veterinary science and veterinary medicine. But also I found that the work that they were doing there was, it was about people, you know, because people have pets and people have livestock and by treating pets and livestock, they were really dealing with people.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in how humans fitted into the work of the RBC. So you'll see more of that sort of work on my other website. At some point, I've got to collide those two things and make the art, you know. But yeah.
Well, it's only a project away, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And if we can just bring it round to full circle to the start of this conversation.
Oh yeah.
And just end on just talking about your day job, as it were, with the Samaritans. The moment we're in at present, you know, there's mental health as sort of people are experiencing it a bit more than ever.
Yeah.
Be it loneliness and, you know, people's lives have taken a change and, you know, they're more or less not in control of their lives at the moment.
That's right. Yeah.
If anyone thinks that they might want to talk to someone, how are they able to go about it?
Well, Samaritans is available for everybody to contact. You can call it for free on 116 123. And that's free. They can call anytime. It's 24/7. Also, it doesn't show up on people's phone bills, that number. It's just so it becomes anonymized. And people can also email. But the best way of finding out about the work of Samaritans, and also about finding out about being a volunteer and what you can do to support and donate, you can just go to the website, which is www.samaritans.org.uk is where they need to go. But if they just typed in Samaritans into Google, they'd find it, right?
Well, Jeff, that's all my questions asked. Thank you very much for the time. I've loved this conversation. And yeah, all the best with whatever comes after Beardy Beardo.
Cheers, Gary. Thanks very much. And if you ever consider letting that beard grow out and shaving off all the hair on top.
Yeah, you can piss off, really. Thank you, mate. All the best.
Cheers, Gary. Take care, mate.
Right, this isn't quite the end of the podcast. I mean, we did actually finish and say goodbye, but we carried on talking for about a quarter of an hour or so after the podcast had finished, and luckily I still had record on. And Jeff mentioned how he saw Maggie Hambling in a gallery. He had an interaction with her, and it didn't quite go as well as he hoped. Have a listen for yourself.
Do you know Maggie Hambling? You must know Maggie Hambling.
Yeah, well, I've done one with her.
Oh, have you done one with her?
Yeah.
She's quite frightening, isn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was at the British Museum about 5 years ago, and I was wandering around, and there was a Maggie Hambling exhibition on there, and I can't remember why they had an exhibition of her stuff in the British Museum, but it was up at the top somewhere, and there was a little group walking around, and I was like, oh, that's Annika Rice in that group, isn't it? So I sort of tailed the group, thinking there might be something interesting happening here, and actually it wasn't anything interesting about the group. It was just that Annika Rice oddly happened to be in this group that was being toured around. But the person doing the tour was Maggie Hambling.
Yeah.
And she was showing all these people her own work, you know, and she was pointing at things and blah, blah, blah. And it seemed like, I think, that all the people going around in the group were art students.
If I could just interrupt, Maggie runs a masterclass every Thursday morning. And Annika's been doing it for like 10 years or something. So that's what it could well have been.
Ah, right. Because at some point they stopped and they were looking at stuff, and then there were some questions from her group to her. Found myself standing at the front of this group. You know, when you find yourself in a place by accident, I just thought this was like a group. So I just sort of stood there and I was listening in. I was like, oh, this is really interesting. And a question occurred to me, and I normally hate myself for asking questions, you know, in those things. And so has anybody else got any more questions? And I found my hand going up. Like, what are you doing? And I asked her a question about something to do with her printmaking, because I'd done printmaking at university. And she was like, she was quite dismissive. I said, I don't know, like this, like, it's a stupid question. It wasn't a stupid question, but, you know, she found it a stupid question. And then she was like, and who are you anyway? I was like, well, my name's Jeff, and I'm just sort of looking around the exhibition. And she just gave me this really, she didn't need to say anything. She just gave me this most withering look.
She's good at
it. I thought, oh, I'm in the wrong place. Yeah. I am really in the wrong place here.
There you go. Jeffrey Harrison. How bloody cool was that? I bet it made you wish you could join in the conversation, didn't it? In the podcast there, Jeff and I were messing about the 97%ers. A 97%er being the little statistic that some negative tutors throw at the students. They say that only 3% of all art students go on to make a living in art. So messing around, Jeff and I flipped it about and said what they should be saying is 97% of you are going to have an absolutely fantastic life after accepting art into your world. So we joked how the illegal motorbike gangs refer to themselves as 1%ers because it was once stated that 99% of bikers are good people. And with a little bit of irony, the remainder referred to themselves as the 1%ers. And they have a little badge saying so. So if you went to art school, but you never pursued that as a career, or you're not yet at the stage you'd like to be, or fucking hell, even if you've made it, but believe that art isn't all about the money, be positive and embrace the 97%. So the Ministry of Arts has wasted no time and made some 97% badges up. If you'd like one, they're only £3.50, including postage. And all of the money will go back in to support the Ministry of Arts podcast. Everyone's a winner, right? Oh, and also, I know Jeff has only just mentioned it at the end of the podcast there, but if you're going through a little something at the moment and you don't give the Samaritans a bell, there's a little bit of disconnect there. And it's always easier talking to a stranger, you know, and on top of that, they know how to deal with that burden once you've put it on them. Give them a bell if you feel you need to. 116 123, and the number doesn't come up on your bill. And if you don't want to talk to them, talk to someone. Like I say every week, on whichever platform you listen to this podcast, you should be able to leave a comment. If you could do that, that really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. If you've got any queries, drop us a line on social media at ministryofarts.org. If you're enjoying these episodes, spread the word of the Ministry of Arts podcast. If you're not, well, fuck you. You won't be listening to this bit anyway. And those of you that are, thanks for listening. And until next week, ta-da.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.